Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening to On Point. If you love this show, you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep On Point and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/onpoint to give. Then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. And thanks. From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jaron Lanier pioneered virtual reality, developed headsets and gloves to immerse users in simulated worlds decades ago. He's still active, now working for Microsoft, and also reflective, one of the most deeply reflective thinkers in the technology world. And he argues that the world is getting creepier and creepier in our high-tech age, suggests VR, virtual reality, could be the evilest invention of all time, could breed behavior modification that borders on mind control. This hour on Point, big tech thinker Jaron Lanier on the promise and perils of virtual reality and more. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How's the tech age turning out? And what about when we go more deeply virtual? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Jaron Lanier, virtual reality pioneer, author, musician, interdisciplinary scientist at Microsoft Research. He's out with a new book. He's had plenty. The new one called Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jaron Lanier, it's been a while. Welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. And I'm so glad that you just keep living and thinking and sharing. Thank you for that. You do it like few others. Oh, man. I remember the first time we sat down, I think it was in your living room in the late 80s with our mutual friend David Levitt, and your virtual reality business, VPL, was just kind of coming together then, and it was all a very brand new notion. I've got a little tape from almost back at that time, if you'll humor us. This was your younger self in 1990 describing virtual reality technology, and including, you talk about iPhones in here, but they're not Apple iPhones. It's a long time before that. Let's just listen for a second, Jaron.
These are the special glasses called the iPhones that you put on, and when you put them on, you're seeing inside an imaginary world instead of inside the physical world. You transport your sensory system into a reality that can be of any description.
Okay, there's the Wayback Machine. What did you expect in 1990, 88 or 89, when we were talking about this, when it comes to VR and compared to what we've got, Jaron?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I guess the first thing I got to say is that I used to talk about the potential dark side, too, as did many others. I mean, none of what's happened is really all that much of a surprise. Mm-hmm. But it's turned out a little darker than I thought it was likely to. We always knew that the types of information technology we were working on, including virtual reality and connecting all the computers, what we call the internet now, all that sort of stuff, we knew it could be turned into a kind of a behavior modification scheme. One of the earliest computer scientists, Norbert Wiener, had even written a book about it called The Human Use of Human Beings. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you put a rat in a laboratory experiment, and every time the rat does a certain behavior, it gets rewarded or punished. And so if you just do that enough, you change the behavior of the rat.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And Norbert Wiener, way back in the late 40s, was talking about how with computers, you could have some sort of a constant monitoring of a person that would give them perhaps slight rewards and punishment and would gradually change their behavior, and the person wouldn't even know. And he comfortingly says, but of course, this would require us to imagine a global computer system with everybody connected wireless with devices.
How could that
on the
ever
person
be? Yeah.
All the time. And he says, yeah, it's just not feasible. That could never happen.
Of course, so, it has.
Yeah, and it's happened. And so in a way, I wouldn't say we've entered the worst possible scenario, but we've entered a darker scenario than we thought was likely. back then.
Interestingly, though, reading you here, it hardly depends on advanced virtual reality. I mean, we're so immersed in social media and more that I read you saying that kind of behavior modification at some pretty significant level is already well underway in our tech age.
Yeah, and I got to say, in your intro, you suggested that I think virtual reality has just turned all evil. I don't think that at all. I actually think it's beautiful, and I'm looking forward to it getting better.
And I read fact, that as well. Sorry if that's a – I don't mean only that mischaracter, but you do say potentially the evilest of all time, and that turned our heads.
No, hey, listen, you got to be a showbiz person to be on air. I get it, but let me just give you the –
You got to be a showbiz person to say potentially the evilest technology of all time, my friend.
Okay, fine. But in a way, I think we're lucky that we're confronting the behavior modification issue, and by that I mean things like swing. Elections. I mean, just the tearing society apart and making people not live in the same world anymore. That's all an effect of people getting customized data feeds that are designed to manipulate them. And we're lucky we're encountering it with such a crude version of the technology now. Having social media in your phone, in your smartphone, is very, very lightweight compared to what could happen with future versions of technology, with virtual reality, for instance. So this is the time for us to figure it out, and hopefully we'll have figured it out by the time the technology gets better.
There's so much I want to talk with you about, and you have wonderful personal stories that are quite illuminating here about all of this. But can we just slow down and stick with that for a second? How you see, and then we'll take it to VR, but how do you see behavior modification in the grip of or in the sway of technology working already, Jaron, right now?
Well, right now, oh my. Okay, here, what happened is there was this really sweet, best of all possible intentions, open-hearted project coming mostly from the left, which I was part of for a while, so I can't blame this on other people. And the idea was that everything online should be free. We should have free music, free news, everything should be free. And I'm sure everybody knows about that argument.
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole political party movement in Europe, the Pirate Party, that in part is based on that idea. But at the same time, we love our tech entrepreneurs. We love capitalism. We love Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. And so the thing is, if you combine those two together, there's really only one solution that gives you both of those things, which is the advertising business model. And whether you think it's annoying or not, traditional advertising isn't mind control. It's a form of persuasion. But the thing is, as the technology advances, what used to be advertising does turn into this kind of laboratory set up for behavior modification, where each person is being monitored and each person receives individualized stimuli, and the stimuli are calculated by algorithms and optimized to change what the person does. And you're no longer in the world of advertising. Now you're in behavior modification.
And so make that very concrete. You're talking about the sort of Facebook advertising model or more. How's it working, and how would it change one's behavior?
Yeah, the principal places where you see it are the various Facebook companies, their properties, WhatsApp, Instagram, and all that. And the search engines, Google, Bing. You see it a little bit in other places too, but those are the main ones. And what happens is...
Yeah, how's it work for somebody saying, wait a minute,
well, okay.
I use Google, I use Facebook, but they haven't modified my behavior.
Oh, yeah, they have. You know, I mean, it's a matter of degree. And I presume that you are a brilliant and pristine person who's resisted more than the rest of us. But even so, you've been modified a little bit. And I have to say, a little bit of behavior modification is kind of normal in life. We do it to each other all the time. The problem with this specific kind is it has a kind of an unrelenting, robotic, and simplistic quality. So I'll give you an example. The prime directive of an algorithm that's customized your experience for any of these services is engagement. It's supposed to make you as engaged as possible. And so there are algorithms that create engagement. It involves not perfect reward in response to behavior, but imperfect. It actually turns out that if there's a slightly scattered reward system, people become more addicted. That's a well-established principle. So what it does is it once in a while gives you this incredible feeling. And now, but then the question is, what feeling is it? So,
I mean, of getting likes or whatever it may be, a little heart,
say again?
Getting likes or a little heart sliding up or some kind of reward.
Well, okay,
like
but
that.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing. There are a whole bunch of emotions that can serve as rewards for engagement. But remember, our reward here is for engagement, not necessarily for feeling good. So we're not necessarily trying to make you feel good. Okay. If you get more engaged for feeling bad, that's absolutely as good. And as it turns out, the negative emotions are more powerful for engagement than the positive ones. So eliciting outrage, annoyance, you know, negative feelings is actually more powerful. And so without anyone making the decision, without any evil genius behind the scenes, the algorithms naturally start to push things that create negative feelings that then increase engagement.
In these customized data feeds you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what you tend to have happen is you tend to have feeds that upset people. They annoy them. They scare them, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then you have people seeing entirely different things because people are annoyed by different feeds. And the it has a perverse effect of taking one person's positivity and turning it into another person's negativity. So one thing that you, and let me explain what I mean by that. The way these schemes work is their fuel is data. They have to have data coming in from people, and so there can be many kinds of data, but the most potent kind of data is data that has some kind of emotional charge. So let's say there's a bunch of people who get together and do something that they feel passionately about. And I'll give you just a couple of examples.
Hold the examples, Joe. Hold the examples, Jaron. You'll hear the music rising behind us right now, and it's your own, Pastoral, also a composer and performer here in Jaron Lanier. His new book is Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. We're talking about behavior modification, and we haven't even come to VR yet. We'll go there and maybe beyond. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Jaron Lanier. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about technology, our times, what's coming, and virtual reality, how that could play out with tech visionary Jaron Lanier. He's out with a new book. He's written many. They're pretty terrific. The latest is Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. There's a lot of memoir in here, but also a lot of thinking about where we are in the arc of technology right now and VR. You can join us this hour. How are we being shaped already by technology, being shaped as humans by social media and more? How are we being changed, molded? And what do you see coming when virtual reality surrounds us? A lot of people thinking about this. This was Elon Musk, and we'll talk with Jaron about him. But this was last year at the Recode Code Conference, talking about Elon Musk, the rapid development of video games over the past half century, how eventually, he said, that will lead to simulations that blur the line between the artificial and natural worlds.
40 years ago, we had Pong, like two rectangles and a dot. That was what games were. Now, 40 years later, we have photorealistic 3D simulations with millions of people playing simultaneously, and it's getting better every year. Mm-hmm. And soon we'll have virtual reality, we'll have augmented reality. If you assume any rate of improvement at all, then the games will become indistinguishable from reality.
Indistinguishable from reality. We're going to go there with Jaron Lanier. Jaron, a lot of callers for you already. Giovanni in Omaha, Nebraska. Giovanni, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Very timely subject. I was literally just talking about this with my middle schooler on our way to school this morning.
Okay.
I recently read an article. It was actually an interview that Jaron did with Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, which kind of sparked our discussion.
She called him the most unusual person she's ever met, a barefoot Buddha with dreadlocks. That's a pretty good description.
Correct. Yes. I was just telling my son, you know, we're kind of living in a very interesting time. It could be scary, could be very exciting, but it all depends on what happens next, right? I mean, okay. Imagine or think about how right now, how difficult it is for people to see what's real news compared to fake news by just because of social media, because yep. There's so much information out there, clicking on the wrong links or what have you. Now imagine in a future where people are walking around with virtual reality glasses, and now it's not just something that they read, but it's actually what they are experiencing, what they are seeing, which, regardless of what anybody else tells them, is true. Well, I see it with my own eyes. This is real. This is real for me. And now if you take that to, you know, the nth degree, what if the companies manufacturing these glasses have a certain point of view that they want to put forth, or they want you to vote a certain way or act a certain way? You know, this isn't science fiction anymore. This is kind of what's happening and what could happen. And, I was just telling him the best thing he can do is to be informed and to not get too carried away with technology and to, you know, search for the truth.
It's a good father's heads up to a son in 2017. Thank you, Giovanni. In Omaha, Jaron, is that what you're talking about?
I have a middle schooler, too, yeah. And that's kind of what I tell her. So sounds like a good dad to me. I do want to take issue with what Elon Musk said, though. My view is not that virtual reality will get better and better until it's indistinguishable, but as long as we stay awake and alive instead of just becoming zombies to it, we'll change. Our powers of perception and our acuity will improve. People are not like these fixed targets waiting to be surpassed. One of my favorite things about virtual reality is it makes you see reality better. So I think in the future, people will stay a step ahead of it and will notice more and more about reality that distinguishes it from virtual reality. And I think that process can go on forever. That might sound unlikely, but I really have that much faith in people.
Can we talk about that for a second? Because that staying awake and alive and resisting becoming zombies to eventually, let's say, a very persuasive virtual reality, I think some people could look around already, just at the, as Giovanni says, at the news flow, or when it's rubbish news, you know, sort of crap news, and say, well, we're an awful lot of people seem to be awfully susceptible already to surrendering the awake and alive part of that, to becoming a bit zombie-ish.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, we might fail. I mean, but we have a chance to rise to the occasion while the technology is still pretty crude. And obviously, a lot of people are falling for it. But we have the opportunity before us to rise above it. And I kind of believe we will. I really do. We did it with language and writing, and I think we'll do it again.
Help us understand if then there's a fork, you know, a dark fork and a brighter fork. Help us understand the distinction. If it should go wrong, what would that look like? If it goes its best or something at least all right, what would that look like as VR becomes more potent?
Well, one of the sad things about this is that it's easier to imagine it going wrong than right, because the bad version is kind of banal and isn't really that hard to imagine. It's been imagined by science fiction over and over again in the works of Philip K. Dick or the Matrix movies, or even going way back to Victorian fiction. We just all become zombies in sort of a stupid world that has no particular real agenda, but just where everybody's kind of just kind of under the thumb of algorithms.
Do we have to be lying in a pod like in The Matrix, or can we be, as Giovanni imagines, walking around with glasses that change the world in front of our eyes and make it something orchestrated?
It really wouldn't make much difference. I mean, the point is it a world of genuine diversity where free people are inventing themselves and the world is creative and the future is different from the past, or do we enter into some kind of a world of brutal manipulation where everything becomes really boring and predictable and everything's the same every day? And, you know, it could go either way. But the thing is that the creative positive future is by definition. I mean, it's just intrinsically harder to imagine because it'll be beyond what we can imagine. So positivity requires a kind of a more abstract faith, unfortunately, and that's a little harder sometimes to hold on to. But I think it's also realistic. I think we will find a way through this that is beautiful and that we can't articulate in advance.
I want to go to the beauty, but could you roll it back for us for a second, for those of us who don't work in this all the time, and just describe materially. You're taking issue with Elon Musk, who says virtual reality could become indistinguishable from reality. But what do you anticipate in terms of virtual reality and how, whether as recreation or more deeply integrated into daily life? I mean, it's in daily life already, as you point out in the book. But well, as we look down the road, what help us anticipate so we can make good choices here?
But before I do that, can I give you just one extremely concrete example of positivity from the present?
Yes, please.
All right. So the most important one to me is in the last few years, my wife battled cancer successfully.
Yes.
And she had a surgical procedure that was designed in a surgical simulator in virtual reality for which the surgeon trained. And as it happened in our case, well, long ago in the 80s,
you had worked
that you were
on
recalling,
this.
I and some of the folks from our group and a surgeon at Stanford Med named Joe Rosen made the first surgical simulator. So we actually started that. And my wife's surgeon was trained by somebody who's trained by him.
Wow,
so we had
a
direct lineage.
That's great.
And she came out of it great. And so the thing about advancing technology is we can confuse ourselves, we can manipulate each other, we can use the technology in really stupid ways, but also, I mean, if we use it well, it is our lives. I mean, it's essential. And so I remain committed to making better technology, and I survive through it. My family survives through it. So we have no choice but to go forward, but to find a way to not confuse ourselves and avoid this sort of darkness that we seem to be entering now. If I imagine the positive future, I don't really know, because that'll be up to the future people. It's not for me to say what they'll be able to do, but I imagine it being like a new form of conversation where people are making up worlds together, where they're changing. You know, in virtuality, one of the coolest things is you can change your body. You can experience becoming an octopus or something. And I imagine people using their sensory motor loop, the way their body is experienced, as a new canvas for art. And
is this just on Saturday night or the weekend, or are these things integrated into daily life in what you anticipate? Maybe more mundane.
Don't knock being an octopus.
Oh no, I don't knock. I'd love to try that out. But is this something you anticipate being, you know, integrated in our lives on a daily basis, like Facebook is now, or
you know, for me, when I really love something, I want to use it sparingly. Like, really, people who really appreciate fine wine aren't the same as the drunks. And like, if you told me who your favorite indie band is, and I said, okay, I'm going to hire them to play on a cart that follows you everywhere 24 hours a day, you'd hate them pretty quickly, right?
Right.
But that's not the way the business works. The business always wants engagement. So if there's VR, there's surely going to be people who want us to be constantly engaged with it.
Well, as long as we're working with the so-called advertising business model, that's absolutely true. I think the only path forward is to have a different business model that makes VR something you appreciate as a rare, special, wonderful thing, a special piece of art, like going to a movie or something, not something that's background music.
So if we are to resist it becoming more deeply embedded, imagine where we should look out for that. What kind of applications might be pushed at us for VR that you would say, be careful about going there?
Well, you know what? Every time I've tried to imagine something really creepy as a warning, somebody actually thinks it's cool and does it. Like that happened with
we're human.
On the gadgets for a movie called Minority Report, and then people actually tried to implement them. So I'm not even going to tell you. Like, forget it. It's not going to happen.
Rhiannon is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Rhiannon, thank you for calling. You're on with Jaron Lanier.
Hi, Tom. This is a really important personal subject. I'm glad we're discussing it.
Great.
I wanted to get your thoughts on how we might be complicit in our own conditioning in terms of technology. I work for a small IT outsourcing company in Waltham, and one of the things that we have to fight against often is that either our clients or competitors of our clients marketing to them kind of treat tech not so much as a tool, but rather the goal, the end solution, the panacea that's going to solve all of their business woes and all of their personality problems and all their relationships. And the feeling that I've gotten is that almost lends us to be, you know, in the wrong frame of mind, that we're allowing ourselves to kind of be swept up more in technology, perhaps not so as mindfully as we should be. And I was wondering if that's a trend that you've also noticed, if you feel like the escapism of VR might exacerbate that, or kind of what your thoughts on that idea of our expectations as to what technology should be for us.
We'll go there. Gerald Lanier, this is right in your wheelhouse. You want to keep it human, but there, you've got Rhiannon, a technologist, you know, worried about this tension. What do you say to her?
Well, the tension is very real, and there's nothing necessarily escapist about virtual reality any more than there is with any other medium. I mean, you can escape into a book, or you can use a book to understand yourself and the world better and to understand someone else. A book can create empathy, not escape. The same thing's true with virtual reality. It really can go either way. And I completely agree with you that we're personally complicit. We are at least starting out in this free enough to have some influence on how free we remain. And I want to try, you know, the problem is that people can fall into a sort of a paranoia, which is disabling because the technology is around us so much. I urge, like my students, I urge young people to at least experiment with themselves by disconnecting substantially, just as a process of knowing themselves, so they have some sort of baseline. Like from in my generation, we might go on crazy road trips to know ourselves. And I feel like these days, the equivalent is just like getting off of social media and getting away from the phone for hours a day and just knowing yourself independently of the tech. And there's no question that'll be hard because it has been designed to be addictive, but that's the point. I think if you can at least know yourself without the tech and have a baseline, then you're in a position to assess what the tech is doing to you and then to be in charge of your own life. And I urge everyone at least to get to that point. And if after doing that, you responsibly feel that you want to be engaged again in what to whatever degree, I think that's great. And if it helps your career, if you think it makes you happy, whatever it is, you're free and you should make that decision. But at least know yourself first.
Rhiannon, thanks for your call. Jack in Oakland, Maine. Jack, thank you for calling. You're on with Jaron Lanier.
Hi, Tom. So I think that this conversation and ones like it are really where the rubber meets the road. These issues are not going away. And it really reminds me of something that I've seen recently. It's a short film made by a group of computer scientists in Berkeley. And the whole goal behind it is to show what can happen in with the militarization of technologies and data. And the group is called Stop Autonomous Weapons. And it talks all about, in a very dark and almost, you know, Twilight Zone way, the potential dangers of this.
What's autonomous weapons? The ones that recognize people, you know, fly around and take them out? We've heard about that on this show. Now, is that what you mean, Jack?
Yes, it is. And so in the video, which is made by, like I said, a group of computer scientists from Berkeley, they're highlighting, you know, how these, with the right, you know, data, these can be used by groups to seek out political enemies of them, you know, across borders. And, you know, it paints a very, very dark picture. And, you know, the short film starts out with a group of shareholders being pitched this technology. You know, in the commercial capacity, we're talking about data today, and you know, they lay it out there like this in a very dark, straightforward, brutal manner, so that people, I think, open their eyes.
Jack, we've got it. I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood plot, and yet you've got real technologists worried about it. Boy, Jaron, you know, every time we turn around, that darkness appears menacing here, right alongside the beauty you want us to keep our eye on.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, that is an excellent video made by folks here at Berkeley. It's about swarms of little drones that are taken over by hackers and start killing Americans, even though they were intended to attack foreign adversaries. And you know, but the thing is, that doesn't even feel that dark. That just is the ordinary negative scenario we talk about. That's a extraordinarily real and viable scenario, and it is important to be aware of them. And I think in that case, it's one of a number of negative scenarios that come out of sort of believing in machines too much and believing that the machines can make their own decisions. And if we set things up to support that fantasy that the machines are autonomous, we're setting ourselves up for endless trouble.
Jerry Lanier's new book is Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. Behind us, one of his compositions, Come Along, kind of a gamelan sound at the opening there. You can join us this hour. Are you excited by VR, ready to dive in? Are you worried you'll be swallowed up, controlled? Where do you feel enhanced by technology these days? Where do you feel diminished? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about technology, our times, what's going, what's coming, and virtual reality, how that could play out with tech visionary Jerry Lanier. He's out with a new book, pretty terrific, called Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You can join us this hour. Where do you feel enhanced by technology? Where do you feel diminished? What about VR then? How does it make us more human or less? What do we need from the lords of tech now to take us to a better place? Not a worse one. Of course, the idea, as Jaron says, has been around forever since Victorian-era science fiction. Certainly, Star Trek loved it, the whole holodeck. Here's a 1988 episode, Next Generation. Captain Picard, Patrick Stewart, enters the holodeck to participate in a simulation of a 1940s detective novel.
Program desired location.
Earth, United States, San Francisco, California.
Time period.
1941 A.D.
Enter when ready.
Captain's personal log. I'm entering the ship's holodeck where images of reality can be created by our computer. Highly useful in crew training. Highly enjoyable when used for games and recreation. The characters I'll meet are generated by the computer, of course, yet they feel real. They seem real in every way.
That was 1988 when Jerry Lanier was in the middle of what he's called the father of virtual reality. 1988, looking back on 1940s, here's just last month. This is Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg visited Puerto Rico through virtual reality, not in body, but to talk about the company's hurricane relief efforts there. He was back at Facebook headquarters in California, but his animated avatar was transported into a 360-degree video that showed widespread devastation caused by Hurricane Maria.
We're on a bridge here. It's flooded. You can get a sense of some of the damage here that the hurricanes have done, and I mean, this is one of the things that's really magical about virtual reality is you can get the feeling that you're really in a place.
Yeah, and over time, what does that mean? How it's shown to us, how we interact with it. Jerry Lanier goes very deep on this and much more in Dawn of the New Everything. Richard in Miami, Florida. Richard, you're on with Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I've been a 360 VR producer for about the last 4 years now.
Great.
And I was just on a VR panel at Digital Hollywood in L.A., and I got to hear all this new exciting technology these guys are working on that are so far in the future. But I like to bring it down to what is really happening for me and for most people probably listening. And when I go on YouTube or Facebook and I look at a still picture now, I want to start moving the screen around to see what's left and right or behind me, and you can't do it. And I think eventually the cameras are so cheap now, and I think eventually everyone's going to be using these cameras and watching 360 stills and videos, and they're going to get very used to it.
Does a 360 video, does that qualify as VR to you, Richard? Is that all it takes, is to have a kind of surround video and that's it? You're there?
Well, there's been some talk on the blogs about VR not really being the right name for this. And I've really changed what I have on my website to frameless video. And that makes more sense to me virtual reality, you know, works for certain things, but there's so many other technologies coming out, light field technology and those types of things. So I think maybe we started with VR as a name, but now it's a little more complicated, and it doesn't really talk about, like, for instance, what I'm talking about, like the 360, the frameless videos.
Yeah. Hollywood, looking at it, Jerry Lanier, how do you see it actually emerging now and in the, I don't know, years right in front of us?
Well, I mean, it's emerged. There's been a renaissance of virtual reality and related technologies in the last 4 or 5 years. And by the way, you can stay up all night arguing about what terms should apply to what, and I encourage you
and
to do
mixed
it.
Mixed reality, virtual, the whole business,
Yeah, there's no right answer. People people love arguing about the terms, and there's a lot of them. But, you know, I guess my feeling about the near term is we've made a little bit of a mistake in that the way we're distributing virtual reality stuff is analogous to the way we distribute movies online or games. You download this thing and then you experience it typically by yourself. And what some people in the field are starting to do and what I believe is the future is a live connection that's fantastical. So sort of a cross between Skype and Hieronymus Bosch, if you like, you know, where you're connecting in real time with to people, but in such a way that everything's subject to change. I do want to say this idea of using virtual reality as a tool for empathy, for instance, of appreciating what happened in Puerto Rico, is something I used to talk about all the time, and I still believe it, but it's not automatic. And there's something strangely discordant about hearing Zuckerberg say, oh, here we are in the devastation of Puerto Rico, and isn't it magical?
Yeah.
There's some lack of emotional connection there. Like, he should be horrified, and he isn't. And that just goes to show that there's nothing automatic in any technology that creates empathy. It requires something from inside yourself and paying attention. And it's so I'm a little concerned that people might think there'll be an automatic empathy machine where there could never be such a thing.
Yeah, isn't it magical? That's kind of an odd response in a way.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Danny in Edgewood, Maryland. Danny, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering about using VR. Microsoft has the Xbox, and I've always wondered why we couldn't have a collaboration with maybe bodysuit so you could actually do our VR labs. You could learn kinetic skills like sports or technical things. You could learn cooking, Tai Chi. You could visit grandma and be right there with her watching her make her apple pie. It's recorded, and your VR suit would give you hints as, okay, you're doing this right, you're doing this wrong, basically patterning, correcting movements to a model, and then you could help repair nerve damage for stroke victims and other people who have had spinal injuries. And maybe have some better games that don't involve killing people, stealing cars, things like that.
Yeah. Jaron, is that coming? Is it here?
Well, absolutely. Everything you just mentioned in your list was something that we did with bodysuits in the 80s, amazingly. As far as commercializing that, I mean, at Microsoft, we tried to bring out something that was suitless that had a bit of that effect, which was called Kinect, you might remember from a few years back. I mean, it's where we need to get. I mean, that kind of stuff that involves the body, the somatic version of virtual reality, is to me the most exciting part. I think it's a little unfortunate that a lot of the folks who get interested in virtual reality become almost so obsessed with the visual part of it, with figuring out the optics and all that, that they forget about the rest of the body. But that's really much more interesting in VR. So I think your sensibility is exactly the right one. And I hope we get there soon, because I do think it's a better, it's more interesting and it's filled with potential.
Elon Musk has come up a couple of times, and I don't know how AI, artificial intelligence, and VR meet in your mind. But he had this to say. This was over the summer at the National Governors Association, and of course, the CEO of Tesla and SpaceX. This is a very brief piece of tape, but here's what he told political leaders there about artificial intelligence and what it is.
AI is a fundamental existential risk for human civilization, and I don't think people fully appreciate that.
Jerry Lanier, we want to ask you about that. AI is a fundamental existential risk for human civilization. And we've got Stephen Hawking in the last couple of days calling AI the worst event in the history of our civilization. How does this intersect with your thinking, your views, Aaron?
Well, see, I don't think AI is a real thing, but I think the belief in AI is an existential threat to our civilization.
I mean, you don't think it's real because it's just harvesting human insights and building them into algorithms.
Right.
Nevertheless, there's something going on there that functions in the world now and presumably will function more and more, whether you, I don't know what you call real or not real, it's happening.
Right. So the example I like to use to illustrate the way I think about this is automatic translation between languages. And there are a few companies that provide these services. I think it's cool and wonderful to be able to get a quick translation of a memo. So I'm happy the services exist. But in order to make them work, we have to steal tens of millions of example phrases from real people who translate every single day. Mm-hmm. And those people aren't informed it's happening. They're certainly not credited or paid. And then the problem is if you say, oh, we've created this electronic personage, we've created this entity that's doing the translating, then it allows you to take the next step and say, oh, those people, they aren't really needed, so they should all get basic income. They're not needed anymore. They'll go on the dole. They're left behind, when in fact we do need them, so that whole thing's a lie. So if you peel back the curtain of AI, you don't find a Wizard of Oz. Instead, you find millions of people who are being stolen from. So it's a kind of a theft, or, you know, and so if we
because AI, as we know, AI, it's built on harvesting tons and tons of human behavior and insight and building into algorithms. So that's the theft. But you see an economic input that's unrecognized now.
Well, it's not just that it's an economic injustice and it can destabilize our future, but it also removes human responsibility where, in fact, it is a human activity. So let's say you have the same effect for targeting drones, where you're harvesting human data to create these algorithms that decide where drones should strike. It's still coming from people, but if you say, oh, no, it's the electronic brain that's responsible, then you're removing the responsibility that it should exist with humans who should be in the loop. And that process of the fantasy that you're building these artificial super beings, that fantasy removes people from responsibility, and that is an existential threat. And in that sense, Elon Musk is correct. But in the sense that there's an actual sort of alien god or something that we're building, that's false. But it's the belief in it that could really screw us terribly.
Jerry Lanier writes in his new book, Dawn of the New Everything, he says, I'm not saying AI is bad. I'm saying it's not a thing at all. Fearing AI is just another way of amplifying the harm done in the name of AI. The only way to reduce the harm is to stop believing in AI as a new type of creature, but instead evaluate algorithms as tools to be used by people. Morris is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Morris, thanks. You're on with Jerry Lanier.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jaron. Considering you were proven absolutely correct when you recommended that the standards for computers be set so that the copying of files could be traced, can you imagine all the problems we're having with security, all the problems we're having with China copying our stuff?
Would have been
eliminated if they would have listened to you. Is the tech community now giving more gravitas to your advice? And getting back to what I just said, I must ask, when you told the people at Xerox PARC that they're going to be doubling the service, that it's unnecessary, and that all the problems that I mentioned would be eliminated, and then they gave you the reason, oh, we're at Xerox, we have to double it because we're using their techniques. Were they aware that they were going to be making out like bandits because they're setting the standards the way they eventually did? Did they know that, or were they just really believing that they had to follow the standards that Xerox was setting?
Morix, we've got it. Jaron, our time's short. I don't know if we can get all that, but it's true. You've been recommending some steps here for a long time. You've got history now, man.
Yeah. So this question is great, but I don't think there's enough time to explain it to readers who aren't familiar with the story. This comes from my previous book, which was called Who Owns the Future,
yeah.
And actually from my book before that, too. And it's a whole long story.
Maybe some guidelines looking forward. If you were right then,
yeah.
It would have been good. Here we are sitting in 2017. What do you recommend for how we grapple with what's coming at us in terms of guidelines? I don't know, new rules. I mean, Jaron's laws.
Well, All right. So what I would like to see is a shift in the business model online away from what's called advertising, which I believe has turned into behavior modification, and instead towards traditional commerce where you'd unless you were poor, in which case it would be free, but most people would pay a small fee to use services like Facebook. And furthermore, you'd have an opportunity to earn money from Facebook if you contribute a lot to it. I'd like to see it fully monetized, or I'd like to cease money and stop Bitcoin and the whole thing and move to a socialist society, one or the other. You can't have this combination. It's killer. It's just you can't combine these two things. But presuming that we would choose capitalism, then we need to really do capitalism and do it online as well. And then we'd have people making a living, so we wouldn't need basic income. And then we'd have – the companies would have an incentive structure for making cool content instead of addictive content, which is totally different. Then we wouldn't open up our marketplace to be a channel for the worst actors in the world. We wouldn't create Christmas for asses, as I call it. So that's what I'd like to see.
Does Zuckerberg take your calls?
I know a few of the Facebook founder types, but I've never met him. I was just in a different loop when he was starting that. But I know Sean and Peter Thiel and a few other people, and we've certainly talked about it. But I haven't ever talked to him about it.
I mean, I guess I'm being tongue-in-cheek, but they're going pretty hell for leather on this advertising model right now, making a lot of money.
Yeah, they got
to change.
They just have to. Basically, they have to change their business model or humanity won't survive. I mean, I really think it's that plain. And so, therefore, I feel confident they will change their business model.
What would instigate that change, Jaron?
I think goodwill and rationality. And call me naive, but I actually believe in those things. And I believe we have basically decent actors here. I know some people will disagree with me about some of the figures, but I think fundamentally Silicon Valley culture is fundamentally rational and good-willed. And so I believe that they'll come to see the light. I don't think it'll happen tomorrow, but I think it'll happen.
A lot of money and a lot of power moving fast there. We'll see if it slows down, looks out the window, listens to Jaron Lanier. Wow, I could go all day and wish we could, but we're very grateful to you for being with us just for this hour,
Jaron. Hey, thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. The new book is Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. Don't miss it. Thanks for joining us. One more piece from Jaron Lanier, thinking hard about escape and return. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.